Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the question and answer session of today's call, you may press star followed by one to ask a question. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. At this time, I'll turn the call over to Brady Phillips. You may begin.
Good morning or good afternoon, depending on where you are, and thank you for joining the call. Again, my name is Brady Phillips with NOAA's Office of Communications, and I'll be facilitating the call today. And during the call today, you'll hear from two NOAA experts to talk about how environmental information from NOAA's JPSS-1 satellite, the first in a series of four advanced NOAA polar orbiting satellites, also called the Joint Polar Satellite System, will be used by scientists to help improve weather and natural hazard forecasts in Alaska. The JPSS satellite launch has been slightly delayed from its original launch date so that technicians can repair a faulty battery on the ULA Delta II rocket. The launch is now scheduled for no earlier than, or actually on Tuesday, November 14th at 1:47 a.m. from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. So our first presenter today is Dr. Mitch Goldberg, the JPSS program scientist with NOAA's National Satellite and Information Service, who will provide a summary of the JPSS program and the capabilities of this new satellite. And our next presenter is Nate Exton, a science infusion and technology transfer meteorologist with NOAA's National Weather Service Alaska region, who will discuss how the data from the satellite will be used to improve weather and hazard forecasts in Alaska. Our first speaker will be Mitch Goldberg from NOAA. Mitch?
Thank you, Brady. So we're excited about the launch of JPSS-1 next week, next Tuesday. Once JPSS reaches orbit, it will be known as NOAA-20. So my remarks today will focus on the satellite and its five instruments that will enhance our global observational capability, especially in the polar area since it is a polar orbiting satellite. And then I'll turn it over to Nate to talk about how these data will be used by forecasters to improve weather and hazard predictions in Alaska. So JPSS-1 is the first in a series of four highly advanced NOAA polar orbiting satellites that will improve the accuracy and timeliness of NOAA's numerical weather prediction models and a 3 to 7 day forecast. The satellite will also provide a wealth of observations that scientists can use to help understand long-term changes to our planet's climate. As you may know, NOAA operates two types of environmental satellites, the geostationary GO-16, which was launched about a year ago. Is above the equator about 22,300 miles above the equator, and it's moving at the same speed as the Earth is moving. So it's always overhead, always observing our part of the world, constantly to monitor clouds, severe weather, things like that. And we have the polar orbiting satellite, JPSS, which basically circles the globe from pole to pole at a much lower orbit, about 512 miles above the Earth's surface. And as it's orbiting, the Earth is rotating underneath it, and that's how it's able to take global observations. Global observations of atmospheric temperature and water vapor is particularly important for the 5 to 7 day forecast. And in fact, 85% of all data that's used in forecast models come from polar orbiting satellites like JPSS. Both satellite systems are critical to NOAA to provide a complete picture of what's happening with the weather today, tomorrow, over the next 7 days, and so on, and tracking how trends may change over time. JPSS, which stands for the Joint Polar Satellite System, will bring the latest and best technology NOAA has ever flown operationally in the polar orbit to capture more precise observations of the Earth's atmosphere, land, and waters that helps improve NOAA's life-saving weather forecast out to 7 days. JPSS-1 will provide data twice as fast for numerical weather forecasts and will have a sounder that has six times the vertical resolution, which means I can see information in the atmosphere in the vertical six times greater than our older NOAA operational satellites. In 2011, NOAA and our partner NASA launched SUMMI-MPP, the precursor to JPSS-1, which was designed as a research mission to test a new technology that would fly on JPSS-1. It was so successful, the satellite operated so well that it became operational back in 2014, and it's actually NOAA's primary polar orbiting weather satellite. JPSS-1 will join SUMMI-MPP, giving NOAA the benefit of two advanced satellites in the same polar orbit. So both are in the 1:30 in the afternoon orbit, which on the other side of the Earth is actually 1:30 at night. And so it orbits from pole to pole, and SUMMI-NPP and JPS-1, which will become NOAA 20, will be separated by 50 minutes, so we'll get twice as much data as just having one. Once JPSS is declared operational after a post-launch checkout, which is about 90 days, NOAA will have the first next-generation polar satellites and the first next-generation geostationary satellite, GO-16, working in tandem. GO-16 becomes operational in December. So JPSS has five different instruments. They're very accurate, very sensitive to temperature change, for example, for less than a tenth of a degree. So if the atmosphere has a temperature change of, let's say, just a tenth of a degree, which is important for being able to forecast weather, these instruments can sense that change. So the first instrument that we have, actually the first two are called sounders. The primary function of these instruments is to provide atmospheric temperature and moisture. So first we have the ATMS, which is a microwave sounder. It stands for the Advanced Technology Microwave Sounder. And it measures atmospheric temperature and moisture. The Earth is always emitting energy, and JPSS has the instruments that look at different spectral regions of the spectrum, basically, of radiation. And in the microwave, water vapor droplets, for example, is a lot smaller than the wavelength of the microwave sounder can see through clouds. So it collects temperature and water vapor through basically overcast conditions. It's also sensitive to surface features, so the microwave sounder can also provide us information on sea ice through clouds. So it's very important for monitoring Arctic ice and how that changes from year to year. So JPSS, which is a series of four satellites, will provide us these observations for the next 20 years, so we'll be able to monitor sea ice change for many years into the future. Then we have the cross-track infrared sounder. That's an infrared sounder with high vertical resolution. That's the 6x vertical resolution I was referring to earlier. It's sensitive to though clouds, so it can't see through clouds, but we use the microwave and the infrared together in order to mitigate clouds. So CRIS, for example, has more than 2,000 channels, 2,000 spectral bands, and the NOAA earlier polar orbiting satellites called HERS only has 19. Then we have a very advanced imager called VIRS, which is the Visible Infrared Imaging Radiometer Suite. And it's used for weather forecasting, environmental assessments. It includes information about sea surface temperature. It's been used for tracking floods, creating flood maps from the recent hurricanes, also for the fires in California, also in Washington State, Oregon, and also up in Alaska. VIRS has very high spatial resolution. It can see very small fires, and that's really important because you want to find these small fires before they become larger. Recent imagery from VIRS and SUMMI-NPP, again, like I said, it's been used for monitoring active fires. We've been using the data in models to predict how the fire will spread over time and also the smoke as well. It has been used for monitoring fog, volcanic eruptions, sea ice. Even at night, we have a day-night band that can see basically visible lights and also can see sea ice at night during the long winters in Alaska. That's, of course, dark. And we use moonlight reflected off the ice, and we can see that. And Nate will talk more about that later. Then we also have an ozone instrument called OMPS, Ozone Mapping and Profile Suite. That tracks the health of the ozone layer and measures the concentration of ozone in the Earth's atmosphere. And data for OMPS helps track dangerous UV radiation that can increase our risk of cancer. And also OMPS helps us monitor the size of the Antarctic ozone hole, as well as its recovery. And then finally, our last instrument is called CERES, the Clouds and Earth's Radiation Energy System, and measures reflected sunlight and thermal radiation emitted by clear and cloudy skies. And all these instruments, they work in tandem. For example, VIRS can tell us the temperature and location of fire, whether in Alaska or Portugal, and track the smoke plume, while the CRIS instrument is sensitive to the carbon monoxide being emitted by the fire. And so we can see how fires can impact air quality. As I said earlier, JPSS-1 and SUMMI-NPP will fly in the same orbit, 50 minutes apart, each crossing equator at 1:30 p.m. local time. and then passing over the North and South Pole every orbit, about every 101 minutes. Each orbit is about 101 minutes. Our European partner, EUMETSAT, they provide weather satellite data from the 930 orbit. So together, these polar orbiting satellites will provide a full complement of data feeding NOAA's weather forecast models. Again, as I said just before, because the satellite passes the North Pole basically 14 times per day per satellite every 101 minutes, JPSS-1 has a unique vantage point to regularly observe the Alaska and the Arctic, unmatched by other satellites and ground sensors. So now I'll turn it over to Nate Eckstein from NOAA's National Weather Service, who will talk more about the National Weather Service, Weather Services, well, how they will use the data from JPSS-1. Nate?
Hey, thank you, Dr. Colbert. I'd just like to start off by saying that for the National Weather Service in Alaska, satellites are a big part of our observing capability. We have a big space. Alaska is very large, as you know, so our traditional surface-based observing networks are very sparsely located. Without satellites, we would have a lot less knowledge of what's going on out there. We only have 7 radars that cover areas in the southern part of the state. And so, again, this capability to have both the geostationary satellite and the polar orbiting satellite is very key to our ability to understand what's going on. The other thing that was mentioned, polar orbiting satellites are very beneficial to our numerical weather prediction, our weather model. And so while that's a side benefit or a really important benefit, it's not necessarily what I would like to discuss today. I think the geostationary satellite for Alaska is a key piece of the observing environment, but it doesn't have a great angle to look north of the Alaska Range, and particularly north of the Brooks Range into the North Slope. So these polar orbiting satellites like JPSS, like SWOMI MPP, give us great detail of what's going on in the environment, on the surface, both for marine, for land forecasts, for aviation forecasts over the state. One of the things that was mentioned was this day-night band on the Visible Infrared Imaging Radiometer Suite, or VIIRS. And so this day-night band, which sounds a little bit like a contradiction, is actually really amazing technology. When this first came to us on SWOMI MPP, it was one of the next best things in satellite technology. Being able to have visible imagery in the nighttime. Visible imagery is probably the most preferred imagery by weather forecasters. Gives us something that we're used to looking at that we can recognize. And it's almost generally a higher resolution than in contrast to infrared imagery. So having a visible like imagery at night gives us great detail to see hazards for aviation like fog in a mountain pass. Before the sun comes up, be able to get that into the forecast to warn the pilot, many of whom in Alaska are general aviation. And so they fly by what's called visual flight rules, which means they have to be able to see where they're going, and they cannot fly through clouds. So this ability to detect small areas in tight places where our general aviation aircrafts are operating is really key. Another ability of the imaging suite is we now have the capability to do some specific products that help us differentiate things that traditional satellite imagery would show us as the same. So, for instance, both snow and clouds look white in traditional infrared imagery. But with JPSS, we can combine multiple channels on this imager together to differentiate clouds and snow really easily for forecasters to be able to detect what's going on. So One other area to help and assist aviation is in the area of volcanic ash forecast. So recently with Bogoslav in the Eastern Aleutian and a lot of activity that's seemingly ongoing year-round in Kamchatka, and the Russian, just west of the Bering, all of these volcanoes that may erupt affect aircraft flying great circle routes between North America and Asia. So there are more than 80,000 large aircraft per year that fly these routes, 30,000 people per day, potentially downwind of an Aleutian volcano. Some of the work in this ZOOM-NPP and JPSS area has allowed to take on this remote sensing algorithm to discern the height and concentration of volcanic ash. And so this has led to a much higher confidence in our forecast because of this information. We didn't have this before. A lot of the old techniques for detecting volcanic ash and determining the height and then figuring out a forecast was very difficult, time-consuming. This allows us to produce a forecast much more quickly, gives us a higher degree of confidence in it, and allows us to restrict the warning area, which tends to result in less reroutes, less delays, and fuel-saving costs for airlines. So this is really a big deal for volcanic ash. Going on to the microwave technology, again, as Dr. Goldberg said, this is really important to be able to see beneath the cloud. So for our sea ice analysts and forecasters, being able to detect the ice edge and forecast the ice movement, the expansion and retreat of that ice through the season, and also on a day-to-day or on a forecast scale to help mariners in the Bering Sea particularly. This is really, really critical. Traditionally, I know that the ice analysts would get lots of satellite imagery. It's one of their primary tools. And, you know, a lot of it would get discarded because there's stratus clouds covering the sea ice edge, and therefore they have to go back and use some older imagery to know where that's at. But with the microwave technology, we now have the capability to see through these clouds in a lot of cases and know where the ice edge is on a more consistent basis, which leads to a more accurate forecast. So these accurate forecasts for sea ice, a tremendous economic and safety impact on Alaska fishing industry. The Bering Sea Crab Fleet deploys hundreds of crab pots, so if the ice advances more rapidly than forecast, these expensive crab pots can be lost. Not to mention that the fishing vessel itself can find itself in harm's way in dangerous ice-covered waters, possibly in need of Coast Guard rescue. We have at times worked with the U.S. Coast Guard, and they've requested assistance from us in their search and rescue activities. In one case, in July of 2014, a Canadian sailboat trying to traverse the Northwest Passage got stuck in sea ice north of the North Slope in the Arctic Ocean. The USDGS, the Weather Service, helped with the sea ice and helped the Healy icebreaker get up there and pull that sailboat out. So it's really critical to be able to know at any time where the ice edge at and help us, assist us in that forecast. Another area that's been really beneficial for the polar orbiting satellites is in hydrology. During this time of year, Alaska can be quite stormy. We get a lot of systems coming out of the tropics that are more or less storms, pretty large storms at times. And one aspect of this is we tend to get what are called atmospheric rivers or large streams of moisture flowing from the tropics to the west coast of the United States, western Canada, and to Alaska. The impact of this persistent flow of moisture into the mountains can produce heavy rains and oftentimes flooding. So in a case like this, just 2 weeks ago down in the Juneau area, on the northern panhandle, on October 26th and 27th, our office in Juneau forecast almost 6 inches of rain to fall in the Juneau area, including Skagway. Much of this rainfall forecast and the warmer temperatures associated with this warm tropical moisture feed produced flood warnings for small creeks and mountain drainage. It even impacted a bridge and had a mudslide down there. So this this ability to see how much moisture is coming off the Pacific Ocean, really, really critical to knowing how much potential there is for this rainfall to fall and for what the flooding and the warning type scenarios we have to issue and deal with these. So this is really critical to being able to know what's going on in that area. Another area of hydrology is with the sea ice, or I'm sorry, the ice jam flooding in the spring. We have a unique breakup scenario in Alaska where our rivers freeze all winter long and then in the spring break up. This uneven breakup can lead to ice jams, which then back up the water, and then when the ice breaks free, it causes flooding issues in certain villages. So we've seen this from year to year. With the river ice, river flood product that we've done through JPSS and Suomi and Peak Creek programs, we've been really valuable in seeing areas where the ice is starting to melt, where there's open water, where there's still ice. It's really valuable to hydrologists and forecasters to know, get a picture of what's going on in places where we don't have traditional observations. And another area, about 2015, we had flooding on the Hall Road, which leads into Dead Horse on the North Slope. And the river flood product in this case was very heavily used. This road was closed for quite a period of time. Two disaster declarations from the governor were issued. The river flood product from Suomi NDP was really valuable in knowing the extent of the flooding and being able to message that to the state and to help them and the ability to get that road back open. So one other area I'd like to discuss is particularly in the springtime or early summer for Alaska is a fire weather. Both Suomi and MPP and JPSS have a hotspot product to detect even small fires. I believe Dr. Goldberg mentioned this. This is really, really key to being able to see things before they become much greater dangers. We can add this hotspot to overlay with other images that enhance smoke and natural color to give highly realistic views of the environment. That's really key to forecasters being able to see what's going on in a way that doesn't require a lot of time. Forecasters don't have a lot of time to analyze things. They have to produce a forecast. So this is these improvements in being able to visualize several things in a single image has really been beneficial to our operations. And then circle back around to the day-night band. It also has a great capability at night to detect smoke. So it's been really valuable to see the extent of smoke, which is also an aviation hazard, but it's also a human hazard and a health hazard. And so we can see the expansion of smoke at night through the day-night band. We can also see with some of the sounding information how deep these clouds are, dense these smoke clouds are. So there's a lot more information that we're getting now through these polar orbiters than we've ever gotten before. And it's really been quite beneficial to a lot of areas in the National Weather Service's forecast operation. Alaska has many, many forecast challenges, so areas where JPSS will be critically valuable. Data that goes into our models to aviation, marine, sea ice, hydrology, and fire weather application forecast. JPSS will assist us in every season, is now especially beneficial at night and all winter long, providing us capabilities we didn't previously have. That's what I wanted to share with you today. Thank you. I'll turn it back over to you, Brady.
Thank you, Nate. We will now take specific questions from the call participants. And again, please be sure to clearly indicate who you'd like to answer the question if possible. And Shirley, can you please remind folks how they can ask a question and queue up the first call? Thank you.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star followed by one. You will be prompted to record your name. To withdraw your request, you may press star followed by two. Again, press star followed by one to ask a question. And one moment for our first question. Again, press star followed by one to ask a question. Our first question comes from Alex Marvin with Alaska Dispatch News. You may ask your question.
Yeah, I'll throw a two-part question into here. One, what is the cost of just the one new satellite that will soon be launched? And then a question for Nate is Alaska weather prediction will go from, and please be honest here, frustrating or woeful to what now with this sort of doubling up of firepower with the JPSS adding to SWOMI's capabilities?
Okay, this is Mitch Goldberg, so I'll answer the cost of JPSS-1. So the cost of the JPSS-1 flight segment, which includes the design, building, and launching of the JPSS-1 satellite, is about $1.6 billion.
Just for one satellite. Wow. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Nate, so I'll answer the question on the improvement to our forecast. I wouldn't describe our as woeful. I'd say that we get the ability to observe more phenomena going on. We're able to realize that and use that to produce better forecasts. So the more you're aware, and it's sort of a continuing continuing ramp up of awareness by a forecaster leads to a better understanding of the environment and a better forecast. So there's a greater observational capability, greater awareness produces a greater forecast.
Okay, thank you.
We have an additional just comment in terms of the cost of.
So I gave you the answer, and you said, wow, and then I'm thinking, like, well, does it sound like a lot of money? And it's not really when you consider that these satellites are designed for 7 years, and once you're in space, if it breaks, you can't fix them. So that's why they have to be designed very accurately, very precisely. So the engineering is tremendous on this to make sure it always works, not just for 7 years, but even beyond 7 years. I mean, we have a design life for seven, but we don't want it to break down at seven. We want it to keep on working. And then if you think about the economic benefits, it's huge. I mean, this data that it collects is the critical data that goes into seven-day forecast. And the seven-day forecast has huge economic benefits for practically every economic sector, right? It's, you know, construction, energy, agriculture, aviation, shipping, fishing, and so forth is really depends on weather forecasts. So, like I said earlier, you know, 85% of the data that goes into weather forecasts comes from polar orbiting satellites. JPSS will continue these advanced capabilities out for the next 20 years and beyond. So, you know, I just wanted to talk about the wow factor. You know, it's, you know, of course, $1.6 billion is a lot of money when you first think about it, but then when you think about just the precision of these instruments, five instruments in space that with a seven-year design life where everything has to be right because you can't fix it once it's in space, and then if you also then throw in the economic benefits, then you'll see that the return on investment is huge for the American taxpayer.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, just press star followed by one. Our next question comes from Sam Friedman with Daily News Miner, Fairbanks. You may ask your question.
Sure. Just a quick clarifying question. In the last answer, there was a reference to the lifespan of 7 years, and then I heard something about 20 years. So if you can explain that a little bit better. And then I'll just have a quick question. If you could, for Nate, if he could expand on one of those examples you talked a lot about, ice dam flooding and fires and crabbing, and if there's just an example, I'd like to be able to quantify what you're able to do with this satellite that wasn't possible or you couldn't do as well with the existing constellation of satellites and other weather forecasting tools. So if there's an example of something that was frustrating or difficult before and that we now predict we could, how, if you could explain how we could now do that better. Thank you.
I'll go with the first one about the Mitch Goldberg speaking. So each satellite in the JPS series, so it's a series of four satellites, and each satellite is designed for 7 years, all right? So it has a seven-year design life. We launch every 5 years because we want to make sure we have continuity of observations, which are really critical. So we have overlap in terms of design life, and we fly two in orbit to make sure, so, you know, JPS-1 will be in the same orbit as UMAPP. We fly two to make sure we always have at least one because these measurements are so critical for applications up in Alaska, for forecast models. And so that sort of explains the 20 years and beyond. So it's not one satellite lasting for 20 years. It's a fleet of four that will last at least 20 years and beyond based on the design life and things like that. And our legacy satellites, sure, we have satellites existing now, but they're long and they're old. I mean, they're way beyond its design life. So the JPSS program is going to ensure that we have a fleet of instruments, satellites, that are always within its design life. Hope that answers that question.
That makes sense. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you again. Just press star followed by one to ask a question.
Actually, I think there was a part two to that question. So, Nate, can you?
Yeah, this is Nate. I'll answer that with the ice jam flooding. So this particular product that I was discussing tells us the percentage of ice or open water or a combination on the rivers in Alaska. So during the springtime, what hydrologists and forecasters are looking for are combinations of ice and open water that could lead, and sometimes in particular to the river's bend and drainage, could lead to an ice jam that would back up the water in the river and then potentially release and cause a flooding in a downstream community. So the product tells us something. Before this product, we didn't have anything that told us information like this, the percentage of ice, percentage of open water in a river area. And so that kind of information is really key to know up and down the whole river system. The Yukon is pretty long. We've got a number of rivers in Alaska that have this issue. And so we have a river watch program where a lot of general aviation pilots in Alaska will provide reports of what's going on as they're doing their normal operations wherever they're flying, will tell us what's going on at that point in the river. That's been a very successful program, but again, it's like our surface observing network. It's pretty sparse. You get a report here, you get some reports there, but you don't really have a big comprehensive picture like you do with a satellite looking down on the entire state, giving us this idea of where the open water is, and then therefore helping us translate that into a hazard for flooding, things like that.
Hey, do you think when the satellite is operational, we'll still need that? We'll still use that Riverwatch program of using airplanes to?
I think so. There's some new areas. They're looking at unmanned drones, things like that. So there's a lot of new technology that's being explored. Flying is extremely expensive, so on the state having some other fiscal issues that I don't really want to get into, but so they're looking at other ways to help reduce the cost of that. I wouldn't say the program will go away, though.
This is Mitch Goldberg. Let me follow up on that a little bit. So what's unique about JPSS-1 in the series is it's incredible high spatial resolution when you consider the amount of real estate that it covers. So you have satellites like Landsat, for example, that have a 30 meter resolution. But the swath, you know, these satellites as they orbit, they scan from like west to east or east to west, so they cover a lot of territory. And so Landsat, it covers less territory. I think the swath is maybe 100 or 200 kilometers wide, which means it takes you 16 days to observe the planet, to observe Alaska, a little bit less because it's higher towards the poles. So we have a sensor that has 375-meter resolution and a technology in which we have these oversampled detector arrays in which the resolution doesn't really degrade that much as you scan out 1,500 kilometers on either side. Compare that to the older generation of satellites on our operational legacy POSE satellites, AVHR, which is an imager that has a 1 kilometer footprint as you're looking straight down, but as it scans, that 1 kilometer grows to like 6 by 8 kilometers, very, very coarse spatial resolution. And so in order to look at small features like river ice jams over Alaska, you can be able to detect these ice jams. We had a recent experience with FEMA with the flooding from Hurricanes Harvey and also Irma. And what they found about the VIRS and its role in flood mapping, it was to be able to cover a lot of real estate that has, you know, so they can see the extent of the flooding. And then once they determine the most vulnerable areas by using other statistics like population centers and things like that, then they're able to prioritize the other assets like flying drones and aircraft data. And so it's all part of like this enterprise different observing systems where you have different layers of observations. And the polar satellite is a big component of that, especially up in Alaska, because we have this high spatial resolution and we cover a lot of real estate. Like from one satellite, you will see Alaska, the entire state of Alaska, 4 times per day. And with JPS-1 and SUMMIT-P, you'll see the entire state 8 times per day with very high spatial resolution, relatively high, considering the amount of real estate.
Thank you. And are you ready for the next question?
Yes, thanks.
Thank you. And that comes from Yareth Rosen with Arctic Now. Your line is open. You may ask your question.
Yeah, hi. I might have missed this, but can you clarify the time element? How long has this project been in the works? Or, you know, when was the start? And then when will the fourth satellite be up and going? I was a little unclear.
So there used to be a program, you know, the POSE program. So our earlier generation satellites started, like, back in the 70s, and that's called POSE. And that's a series of satellites started with TIRIS and all the way to NOAA 19, which is still operating today. So that's POSE. The new generation, so every time you have a new generation of satellites, you have to start planning early. And you plan, like, 15, 20 years even before the first one is launched, and normally about maybe a good 15 years. So we started the planning of this system under a program called NPOSE. If you probably heard about NPOSE, but it was a combined DOD, NOAA, NASA mission trying to fulfill a lot of requirements. And it just was hard to manage. And so we separated from NPOSE back in probably 2010, I think. And we formed JPSS, which was going to be just a joint polar satellite system focused on the afternoon orbit, 130. And so a lot of the development already took place under the NPOSE program. And so the program was modified to focus on the early afternoon orbit with these 5 sensors that I talked about. And now with JPSS-1, so they're building all these satellites, consecutively, in the same block, J1, J2, and then we have a follow-on program called the Polar Follow-On that will have J3 and 4. They're essentially all clones, and it provides us with a continuity. So they're going to be launched about every 5 years. I think J2 is now scheduled for 2021, then the next one is 2026, then the next one after that is 2031. Does that answer your question?
What could you say is the start of when did this program start?
The JPSS-1 program started in 2000 and 2010-11 time frame. That's when it was when NPOs, when we decided to cancel the NPOs program, it was adjusted. You know, the program was adjusted to serve NOAA operational needs. Even though other agencies still benefit, it was designed to serve NOAA operational needs. And so that program became a Joint Polar Satellite System back in 2010.
And the length of time it takes to design the satellite?
There's something common. There's this common, it takes a long time to design satellites. So you got to get everything right. And you got to, because it needs staying power. You know, once you design a generation, you have these satellites for the next 20 years. So it takes a while because first you have to spend at least a couple of years on user requirements, you know, understand what the user needs for the next 20 years. I mean, that's hard to do. But we do it anyway because we have projections of where forecasts are going to go in the future, other needs. So that takes a while. Then you have to do some preliminary design concepts, you know, because these instruments are new. You have to come up with prototypes and you have to figure that out. And once you make a decision based on different design concepts, then, you know, showing that they meet our requirements that was established by the user community, then you go into the engineering phase and then you go into production phase. So it takes a long time. Historically, it's consistent. So it's about, I would say, at least 15 years, even 15 to 20 years. And so there's a lot of examples of that, like the GOES-R program, which is GOES-16. That started in the early 2000s, and maybe 2002 to 3 starting, you know, that time frame of getting their user requirements together. And that was launched in 2016. So it's a good, I would say, 12 to 15 years. I think that's typical. I know the European next generation of satellites, that's going to be launched in 2021, and that planning took place in 2005. And so, yeah, I think an average length of time is about 15 years between establishing the user requirements to launching a satellite. It takes a lot of time, a lot of engineering, because, again, these satellites, it's not just a CubeSat or a small sat that you launch and then they last for a year, you're demonstrating. These are operational systems that has to have the 99.99% reliability. Sometimes I compare it with, like, imagine if someone says, okay, I need you to build a car. But that car, well, it has to last for 7 years. And by the way, you can never take it into a repair shop. You can't change the oil. You can't do anything like that. So you imagine in space, which is, which is in a hostile environment sometimes. You have space debris, all these other things going on, radiation. And you have to have a satellite that is just as accurate as the first day it was launched for the next 7 years. And there's no one that can go in space and fix the satellite. So that's why it takes a long time to get everything right. And you want to make sure that the requirements are being met by, you know, that the user requirements have been well vetted and it's part of the system. And so it just takes a long time. But it's normal. That's a normal amount of time. It takes about 15 years.
Thank you. At this time, I'm showing no further questions. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, just press star followed by 1. And one moment, please, for our next question. One moment, please. Our next question comes from Matt Miller with KTOO. Your line is open. Go ahead with your question.
Yeah, I was just kind of curious how much of an impact, if that could be described, how much of an impact is all this extra data, all this extra resolution, is that going to have on the modeling and the actual forecast that is produced by various offices, whether it's, you know, 3-7 days out or whether it's for varied terrain within certain areas in, like, Alaska coastline. Can that be described as far as how much of an impact that's going to have on the day-to-day modeling and forecast production?
All right, I'll give it a try for the general forecast impact. So when people do studies and they determine, you know, which satellite, you know, data impacts the forecast the most or which reduces forecast error the most, it's always things about the atmosphere, the atmospheric temperature and water vapor. And it always has to be global because, you know, a system out in, you know, typhoon out in, you know, off of the coast of Japan can cause these big atmospheric river events that will set up other storm systems that will, let's say, hit Alaska or the West Coast. And so those data sets are critical, and there's a number of different examples of this, like the Europeans, you know, the ECMWF that has, the European weather model, which everyone knows about. They, you know, back in Hurricane Sandy, they were in an experiment. You know, their Hurricane Sandy, which hit New Jersey, was actually well forecasted 5 days in advance. And they did an experiment and says, okay, let's take all the sounder data, you know, these microwave infrared sounders, let's just take them out and let's see what happens to the forecast. Well, that five-day forecast, that storm, that hurricane was well out to sea, no harm to the East Coast. And so it really makes a difference. The you know, there has been tremendous improvements in the 3 to 7 day forecast over the last 10 years. And that improvement is a combination of the advanced observations, mostly from microwave and infrared sounders, as well as the modeling, you know, as well as the computer power. And so, you know, we're part of this forecast enterprise system, what people like to call it, where the observations are critical. And again, when you decompose and you try to say, you know, which observations are the most important observations for allowing to do an accurate 7 day forecast, it's really the polar satellites. The polar satellites, I mean, Louis Chelina, director of Weather Service, says it all the time. The polar orbiting satellites are the backbone with respect to observations going into the model. And so I can't overstate the importance of that data for the forecast models. And what JPS is doing is providing the long-term operational continuity of these advanced measurements. And so we had, you know, in the past, research missions that have these advanced capabilities, like NASA has AQUA, has an instrument called the Atmospheric Infrared Sounder that is like a CRIS. But that's a research mission, and that can stop at any moment. There's no follow-on. CRIS and ATMS. ATMS is an advancement of the microwave sounder unit that we had on our OSE legacy satellites, but it's a big improvement over that. So anyway, not to repeat myself so often, but what I tried to say, tell you that these global observations, microwave and infrared sounders, they're critical. They're critical to the model, and our JPS's program is ensuring that continuity of those observations, that we're always going to be able to feed the model with those data sets. And JPSS has a different ground segment architecture that will actually provide those data to models twice as fast, so more data can get into the model as well. And then for the real-time applications, it does make a difference. Nate can speak more about that, but, you know, be able to look at, you know, have clarity of monitoring ice, for example, in the Arctic during the night has important impacts. Being able to see the small fires before they become large is important, too. Also, the smoke forecasting. We've been putting, you know, VIRS has, for the very first time, a very good, MODIS had it, too, the NASA satellite. You know, we have an instrument called MODIS that also has this capability. But VIRS, of course, continues that into the future with higher space resolution with respect to the entire scan. But we have this very sensitive channel that can see the hot spot of the fire, how hot the fire is. And when you put that into a model, it will tell you what the injection level of the smoke will be. And that's very important because how high the smoke gets into the atmosphere, then with the prevailing winds, you can forecast where the smoke's going to go to. The smoke from Alaska can reach even Europe.
smoke, fires in Oregon can hit the East Coast. And often the fires will not stay aloft. They will reach the surface, and that impacts air quality. So I hope that answers your question, kind of. I think Nate might have some follow-ups on how important it is up in Alaska.
Yeah, this is Nate. To just kind of go off of the weather modeling comment, the Weather Service uses a rather model-driven forecast process. Our way we produce our forecast is very much driven by the weather model. So that improvement that these polar orbiters provide to that comes out in the forecast in that way. The observational capabilities that assist the forecaster and the nowcast and the real, the short term, giving them capabilities to observe things that they might not otherwise have been able to see with past technology. So they're able to maybe correct where the models aren't. The forecasters know certain system biases and things, so in their training approach, they learn what certain technologies can do, what they can't do, and so those things are applied to a rather model-based forecast.
So would and this may be kind of the wrong thing to ask, but would it, for example, increase the certainty of that particular forecast from, say, 33% to instead 75 or 80%? I mean, can you describe it that way?
I just don't have those numbers to say that, but it's certainly going to be an increase.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have those numbers exactly, but we could say, for example, without Polar Sally data, the accuracy of the 7-day forecast would degrade considerably in a 5-day as well. So, for example, instead of having high confidence, right now I think when you look at anomaly correlations, and that's how well the forecast agrees with the observations, like 7 days out, it's roughly, 7-day forecast is roughly about 80% confident level. And so that would certainly fall down to a much lower level, maybe 70%, 60%. So much that I don't think you would be able to show a 7-day forecast. You would have much lower confidence. Again, in the last, last 15 years, there's been, if you go back 15 years ago, I don't think you would see a 7-day forecast on TV. I'm not sure. I believe I'm right about that. I think if you look at the introduction of the 7-day forecast, that took place about, 10, 15 years ago with high confidence. And so, and it's really the global observations. I mean, to forecast weather after 7 days, you need observations on the other side of the planet, or at least the other side of the Pacific or Alaska. And so so it does make a difference. I don't have statistically what those numbers are. There are, I do have one. I do have a study that the Weather Service did for Hurricane Irene. And it basically showed the cone of uncertainty if we had the modeling and the data that we had back in 2001. And it showed that the cone of uncertainty was so much wider if we had the observations, the old generation systems and even the modeling, where the cone of uncertainty reached all the way to the coastline of Florida, which would have resulted in evacuation of some of those areas. While the actual 2011 run was that cone of uncertainty stayed offshore, so you wouldn't have to do that. But there are statistics out there that I don't have with me now, but they do studies all the time. Like for example, this whole study that I talked about, with the Hurricane Sandy is a great example of the importance of polar orbiting data.
Mitch, this is Nate. Can I add to that?
Sure.
So So I think the importance, like what you're saying, with this, being able to do a 5-day forecast or a 7-day forecast, and for a forecaster to have confidence in that, it's really important, sort of, in that its effect on decision makers in these high impact events like hurricanes. If you're going to order evacuations, be able to do so in as precise a way as possible to not impact people needlessly. And so for Alaska, we're supported primarily through Anchorage and shipping from Pacific Northwest. And so if the Port of Anchorage has an issue, then the state of Alaska has an issue. And they need to know well in advance because of the moving of supplies around the state. All of these things take a number of days to do. If we were going to evacuate a community on the West Coast because of a Bering Sea storm, knowing that 5 to 7 days out versus having the same confidence just 3 days out doesn't really give them enough time to make the correct actions and to move people out of harm's way. So it has this really direct follow-on or cause and effect.
I would say this is Mitch again. I would say almost like the use of polar opening data, because again, these global atmospheric temperature and water vapor information that comes out of them really allows you to, you get to extend the 3-day forecast out to 5 days in terms of accuracy, and the 5 days accuracy out to 7 days. I think that's fair to say. There's plenty of studies that support that. So that's why it's so critical. That's why we always say the polar orbiting data is the critical data needed for accurate 3 to 7 days forecast. And as Nate mentioned, I mean, just the confidence level that we have with those forecasts. Harvey, Irma, and Maria, those were really good forecasts. I mean, the 5-day forecast of Hurricane Irma, I mean, showed, you know, the Tuesday before, the forecast for Sunday morning was right off the Key West, and guess what? It was right off the Key West, and that allowed emergency managers like FEMA and state and local governments and the public to really get ready. They need plenty of time to get ready for these extreme weather events, and it's the 7-day forecast, 3 to 7-day forecast gives them that confidence, and the data that goes into that 3 to 7-day forecast is primarily the most critical data, again, is from the polar orbiting data satellites with microwave and infrared sounders.
Okay, we have one final question.
Thank you. And that comes from Alex Marvin with Alaska Dispatch News. Your line is open.
Can you just illustrate for me how JPSS specifically is different than Suomi? I'm understanding that they're generally similar, and that's why I called it a doubling of firepower. Since we first had the improvement, I think, in 2012 when Suomi was launched, and that the doubling of firepower, I'm understanding, is really a key benefit here. So anyway, what's specifically different to start?
All right. So Suomi FP, it was a research satellite, like I said, that worked really well, that we made operational. And so, and JPSS-1, and it has a 5-year life, design life. So it's really, right now it's beyond its design life. JPSS-1 is more robust. It has a 7-year design life. Each satellite in the series will have a 7-year design life. And also it uses getting the data to the weather forecast models as fast as you can is really important. And so the architecture, the ground architecture, you have a satellite in space and now you have to get the data to the ground. So for the global models, now we're using a big antenna in Svalbard. This is north of Norway. It's part of Norway, but it's an island off the mainland of Norway. It's very high latitude. And we're using one in McMurdo as well. That's in Antarctica. And so by having these two ground stations, we've actually improved the latency. I mean, we reduced the latency by a factor of 2. So instead of taking, let's say, on the average, 100 minutes or 100 minutes to get the Suomi MPP data into global models, 100 minutes would be like 95% of the data in 100 minutes gets to the global models. With JPSS-1, It's going to be about a little bit less than 50 minutes. So more data will get into the model. With
15 minutes, 1-5.
50, 5-0. On the average. And that means that about each different model has different cutoff times. So for the global model, we're going to be able to get 85% of the data into the model in time. And that's a big plus. The instruments are basically the same, but and so that doesn't change much. But again, it's a design life, and the data latency is better. And of course, now we're operating with two satellites in orbit, 50 minutes apart, so we'll have twice as much data for applications. Up in Alaska, they use direct readout, so they have their own antenna up in Alaska. And so as the satellite passes over, they receive the data directly. So the latency doesn't change for those local applications. The data comes in as fast as from SUMI MPP or from JPS S1.
Thank you.
Thank you. At this time, I'm showing no further questions.
Okay. Thank you. And I believe our hour is up, and I'd like to thank the speakers for their time and everyone else for participating in the call. As a reminder, the JPSS 1 satellite is scheduled for launch at 1:47 a.m. Pacific time on November 14th. You can watch it on NASA TV Live, and as well as NASA TV will broadcast have a show before the launch starting at about 1:15 a.m. Pacific time. So good late night viewing. And if you have additional information about JPSS satellite, it can be found on the website at https://www.nesdis.noaa.gov/JPSS-1. If you do have further informational needs or need a follow-up question answered, please feel free to give me a call at 202-407-1298 or email me at brady.phillips@noaa.gov. Thank you. This concludes the call.
Thank you. This does conclude today's conference. We thank you for your participation. At this time, you may disconnect your lines.